This is a Slate, the Institute for Policy Studies radio series Defining the Issues, June 14, 2007 presents The U.S. Government Harbors Terrorists, the case of Luis Posada Carriles. Our host MC is John Cavanna, Director, Institute for Policy Studies. Our panel is Jose Perchera, attorney for the Venezuelan government in the extradition of Posada, and Saul Landau, fellow, Institute for Policy Studies. Total running time is 58 minutes, 0 seconds, with a break at 29 minutes, 0 seconds. The program begins in 3 seconds.
Welcome to Defining the Issues, the National and Global Affairs Program of the Institute for Policy Studies. I'm John Cavanna, Director of IPS, and you can find out more about us on the web at www.ips-dc.org. Today we are discussing the thorny issue of how the United States government, which now frames its foreign policy as fighting an endless war on terrorism, has aided and abetted and harbored terrorists on U.S. soil. In particular, we are focusing on the case of confessed terrorist Luis Posada Carriles. Posada is accused of involvement in numerous terrorist acts. We will get into these, including the 1976 bombing of a Cuban airliner, which killed 73 people. In April 2007, U.S. authorities released Posada from jail, and they've denied the Venezuelan government requests that he be extradited. Our guests today are attorney Jose Perchera and Institute for Policy Studies fellow Saul Landau. Perchera is representing the Venezuelan government in their extradition case for Posada. Landau is the author of Assassination on Embassy Row, an investigation of the 1976 car bombing, also carried out by anti-Castro Cubans, which killed his IPS colleagues, our IPS colleagues, Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Carpen Moffat, in Washington, D.C. Welcome to both of you to Defining the Issues. Let me start first with you, Jose Perchera. Could you first just tell us tell us a little bit more about who Luis Posada is?
Well, thank you, John, for the invitation. You know, IPS is a very special place in my heart as well. I came here in 1975 to go to graduate school at Georgetown, and I was somewhat surprised at Georgetown that nobody cared about what was happening in Latin America and the dirty war, and I found IPS to be an oasis in this city, and it's an honor for me to be here with you and with Saul. Let me first correct something that you said. The U.S. government has not denied Venezuela's request for extradition. Venezuela presented its request for extradition 2 years ago tomorrow, on June 15, 2005, and we have received a single formal response, which was in November of 2005, where the State Department informed us by way of a diplomatic note that it had questions and concerns about the case that they would soon formulate and send to us. They have never sent us those questions. The case is still pending and has been publicly, the U.S. government has said it's pending. But moving beyond that, Posada Carriles is the Osama bin Laden of Latin America. He is one of the worst terrorists in the history of the Western Hemisphere. He's responsible not only for the downing of a passenger plane in 1976, he is responsible for many, many acts of terrorism perpetrated against Cuba and against governments who he thinks are allies of Cuba and businesses who he thinks are allies of Cuba. He has got a long history of terrorism, including trying to blow up an auditorium full of Panamanian students in 2000, masterminding a campaign of terrorist bombings in Cuba that resulted in the murder of an Italian by the name of Fabio Di Chelmo. He had a long storied career in Venezuela as chief of special operations for the Venezuelan Secret Intelligence Agency in the early 70s, where he was personally responsible for tracking, interrogating, torturing, and murdering some of the opposition leaders in Venezuela. So he is a very notorious individual.
Yeah, let me, since the centerpiece of the case against him being a terrorist, or the case for him being a terrorist, is the downing of the Cuban airliner, I want to shift for a moment to a clip from a brand new feature-length documentary, which has been done by the renowned Venezuelan filmmaker Ángel Palacios. The film is called Posada Carriles, Terrorism Made in USA. It's a Telesur and Panafilms co-production, and we're going to play you a brief minute-and-a-half audio sample from this important work, which includes a pronouncement by one of Posada's close associates, Orlando Bosch, who we will get into in a moment as well as the narrator's intro and the last communication from the cockpit of the Cubana airliner before it was blown up mid-flight over Barbados, killing everyone on board.
Seguirá la lucha y seguirán los atentados en toda forma y manera a nuestro alcance.
The terrorist attack of October 6, 1976 was known as the plane case. The judicial process that followed drew the attention of the headlines for over a decade. This terrorist event threw light on the existence of a terrorist network of extreme right-wing activists that had been operating since the 60s under the control of the Central Intelligence Agency of the USA. Posada Carriles and Orlando Bosch were key figures in that terrorist network, whose death prints live on throughout recent history.
Immediately, we had fire out there.
You had a false fire, you returned to the city.
The pilot's one of them. Okay, you see what you had a false fire. I requested immediately. La puerta, cierre la puerta.
You had a false fire, you had a false
fire. That's the bill. Pégate abajo, fire, pégate abajo.
Okay, Jose Pertierra, could you explain a bit what we've just heard here?
Well, John, that was the voice of the pilot, a man that named Wilfredo Perez that they called Felo. On that plane were 73 people, 57 of them Cuban, 11 of them Guyanese, and 5 Koreans. The average age on board was 30 years old. Because the Cubans who were traveling were members of the Cuban fencing team, the juvenile fencing team of Cuba. They had just won gold medals, bronze medals, silver medals in Caracas at the games. And what you hear is what happened immediately after the second explosion above the aboard that plane. There were two bombs that were placed on that plane. One underneath the seat of one of the people who actually placed the bomb, by the name of Freddy Lugo, and the other one in the rear bathroom of the plane. The plane took off from Barbados, and 9 minutes after takeoff, the first explosion occurred. And the voices of the pilots on the recorder, as it was recorded at the airport, indicated there was an explosion and a fire on board. The plane continued on for 10 horrifying minutes, if you can imagine, a scorched plane where people are choking on the smoke. That was the last 10 minutes of the lives of the people who survived the first explosion. Nonetheless, the pilot was able to radio in to the airport and ask for permission to land when the second explosion occurred in the rear bathroom of the plane on a bomb placed there by Hernan Ricardo, the other bomber who was on the plane who had gotten off before the plane had departed from Barbados. That second explosion was the one that affected the navigational system of the plane and brought it towards the earth. The pilot sees that he is approaching a beach that is ironically called paradise. And he sees beachgoers on the beach. And you hear the voice of his co-pilot telling him, that is worse, fellow, pégate al agua, hit the water. And so the plane abruptly banks to the left and hits the water and sinks deep into Deep Water Bay. The remains of many of the passengers have never been recovered. Of the 73 people who died aboard that plane, only 9 bodies were recovered, and most of them in little pieces. One little girl who was aboard that flight is a little girl by the name of Sabrina Harry Paul, 9 years old, She perished. She was one of the bodies recovered. And I'll just briefly read you before I turn it over back to you, John, from the forensic report of what condition her body was in. Body of a girl. This is a doctor speaking. Body of a girl around 9 years of age, brain missing, only facial bones, scalp and hair remaining, lungs shattered, heart destroyed, liver and intestines shattered. That was the condition in which most of the bodies were recovered, if they were recovered at all.
Okay, and then could you tell us the role of Posada and this other fellow, Bosch, in that attack?
Well, we know, you know, it's not a secret what happened aboard that plane, John. Documents tell us, not documents from Venezuela, documents from the United States Intelligence Agency tell us, documents from Trinidad and Tobago, where the two bombers who were aboard that plane, who actually placed the bombs, were captured. These documents tell us that Posada Carriles, Orlando Bosch, Hernan Ricardo, and Freddy Lugo conspired in Caracas to purchase the plastic explosives that were placed aboard that plane. Days before the downing of the plane, Posada told a CIA source in Caracas, as reported by a CIA cable, that he was going to hit a Cuban airliner and that Orlando, namely Orlando Bosch, had all the details. No one in Washington notified Cuban authorities of this impending attack. We have confessions from Freddy Lugo and Hernan Ricardo, the two Venezuelans who were captured in Trinidad, who admitted having worked for Posada Carriles, being trained by the CIA, being trained by the Venezuelan Secret Intelligence Agency in explosives. We have phone calls that were placed by these individuals to Caracas trying to reach Posada and Orlando Bosch in Caracas, telling them in coded words what had happened. They said, the bus has crashed and the dogs are dead. That was a code that was agreed upon. The bus was, of course, the plane, and the dogs were, of course, the passengers. We have vouchers from the company, an intelligence company that Posada ran in Caracas, showing money that was paid to Freddy Lugo and Hernan Ricardo to down the plane. I have the calculations of how much money each of these lives were worth. They were paid $25,000 to blow the plane. 73 people were murdered. That means that each of their lives cost $342.47.
Okay, that's Jose Pertierra. He's representing the Venezuelan government in their extradition case for Posada. Let me shift now to IPS fellow Saul Landau. Saul wrote a piece in Progreso Weekly a couple of months ago that traces the origins of Posada and the people he worked with in the numerous terrorist acts that have just been laid out by Jose Pertierra way back to the Eisenhower administration. I think most Americans think of the U.S. getting involved in efforts to get rid of Castro. They associate it with Kennedy and the Bay of Pigs. You put it back to Eisenhower. Could you explain what your rationale is on that?
Well, the rationale has to do with the facts, John. Before the Cuban revolutionaries marched into Havana triumphantly, in January of 1959, the United States Embassy had been colluding with a series of generals and admirals in Batista's armed forces to organize a military junta to take power so as to prevent the revolutionaries from actually acceding to control of the government. This was under a General Cantillo. At the same time, generals, colonels, majors, and captains in the Air Force, in the Navy, and in the Army, and the police were hijacking boats and planes that belonged to the Cuban government and flying them or sailing them to the United States. These were Batista officers who would have been, of course, tried for war crimes in Cuba. When they got to the United States, they were not apprehended. Indeed, they were treated sort of as heroes. And the boats and planes were not returned. And no charges were ever pressed against any of these people for hijacking. All this takes place before January 1st, 1959. Following the takeover by the revolutionaries of power in Cuba, I think you'd have to say that the entire context of U.S. relations with Cuba can be summed up in one word, terrorism. That was essentially what U.S. policy was from 1959, and it, in a sense, remains that to this day. There were brief interludes where it had abated, especially under Jimmy Carter, but by and large, this was the total context of relations that the United States has had with Cuba. I remember attending a seminar in Havana in 2001 in April, where two former high CIA officials came down. This was the 40th anniversary of the Bay of Pigs invasion, or fiasco, as it got called here. And both of them testified about what were called Operation Mongoose, and another one that was much more secret even than that, called Autonomous Operations. Mongoose was a CIA plan to take Cubans, send them back into Cuba on rapid boats with machine guns or cannons, or send in groups that would land and then do sabotage. Those who didn't land would strafe or fire artillery at Cuban targets. Others would land, they would assassinate a teacher, a couple of soldiers, a local militia person, or a member of the Committee for the Defense of the Revolution, and then they would flee again on their rapid launches. Now, when I say these happen frequently, we're talking now of thousands of these incidents. Autonomous operations was even more sinister, as the former director of this, Sam Halpern, told the absolutely shocked audience in Havana, Cubans would approach the CIA that had been authorized by Attorney General Robert Kennedy. They would get from the CIA explosives, weapons, cash, rapid launches, and even sometimes small planes, and logistical assistance. But the CIA didn't even know what their targets were. CIA official Halpern called this poor tradecraft. So devastating had these attacks been on Cuba that Fidel sent, well, how should I say it, his most trusted lieutenant, Ernesto Che Guevara, to a secret meeting in Uruguay in August of 1961, some 6 months after the Bay of Pigs. At that meeting, Che Guevara met with Richard Goodwin, who was President Kennedy's Latin America man. And in the course of a conversation that lasted several hours, Che offered the following to Goodwin. He said, Cuba is willing to negotiate the following items. We're quite willing to stop exporting revolution, which seems to be your main complaint. We are willing to cut way back on our Soviet military ties, because that bothers you. And finally, we are willing to compensate the American corporations that were expropriated after the revolution. Those are the three grievances you have. There's our offer. And Goodwin said, well, what would you want from us? And Che said, leave us alone. Goodwin took the report back to President Kennedy, and Che had given Goodwin a box of Monte Cristo number ones, which were Kennedy's favorite cigars. And as Kennedy lit one, he said, you know, Goodwin, actually, you should have smoked the first one. That was, of course, referring to one of the assassination attempts where they were going to poison one of Fidel's cigars. Goodwin reported to Kennedy, and Kennedy said, well, it sounds like weakness on their part. Let's turn up the heat. Now, ironically, this decision to turn up the heat, that is to escalate the terrorist war, led directly to Cuba's accepting Soviet intermediate-range ballistic nuclear weapons and intermediate-range bombers capable of carrying nuclear payloads. That led, of course, to the missile crisis of October 1962, directly. All right, so there is the context for not just U.S.-Cuba relations, but terrorism led the world to the brink of nuclear war. It didn't stop. That is, once you have, how should I put it, trained and encouraged what I like to call a pool of crows, because there's a Spanish saying I'll try my best to translate it. Criaron cuervos. Se cría cuervos y saca los ojos. If you educate crows, they come back and peck your eyes out. And this is essentially what the United States did. They trained an entire pool of crows. And one of these crows was named Luis Posada Carriles. He seemed to be, how shall I say it, a more determined crow than the others. I mean, he's on it. He's, I think, almost 80 years old now. And I keep telling people that he heads an organization called GAS, which is the Geezer's Assassination Society. Posada Carriles, in between visits to his proctologist, plots assassinations, along with his other friend Orlando Bosch. They go to their gerontologist, they cash their social security checks, and then they plot terrorism. And they do so in Miami, Florida. And they do so with the support of a whole bunch of other crows that live around them. This is a culture of crows. And these people were all essentially taken in. It started under Eisenhower. This is when the plan began. The idea was the United States does not tolerate disobedience in this hemisphere. It had proven that in the past many times. Every time a Latin American president would try to demonstrate independence, well, we had an era called gunboat diplomacy. A gunboat would move down there, fire a few shells into the capital city, the president would leave, and the United States would install a new president. Later it became dollar diplomacy, where you could buy them out. Later it became good neighbor diplomacy, and one of our best neighbors was a man named Somoza of Nicaragua, and another good neighbor of ours was Fulgencio Batista. Venezuela, of course, had its own dictator, as did Colombia. So there was a whole host of, American lackeys who were dictators, but the policy was the same. Anybody who disobeys gets punished. In 1954, the Guatemalan people elected Jacobo Arbenz as president. It was a free, fair, democratic election. Arbenz planned to make certain reforms. These reforms didn't sit well with certain American corporations, especially the United Fruit Company. Many of the major stockholders happened to hold cabinet posts in the Eisenhower administration. And Eisenhower declared that such an act was equivalent of communism. Arbenz was therefore an enemy in the Cold War, and the CIA led a successful plot to overthrow him. So there's nothing new in this. The question is the method. Now, in Cuba, this was the method. You train and educate a pool of crows, several thousand of them, send them back to Cuba to invade the country, and everything should fall as it did in Guatemala, only it didn't in Cuba. The Cubans resisted successfully, and the United States has felt absolutely wounded by the audacity of the Cubans to resist an invasion of the United States. And this has burned in the, It has burned in the heart of the national security elite for almost 50 years.
Billy.
This is Saul Landau from the Institute for Policy Studies. Saul, in the piece you wrote about Posada, you do focus a great deal on both Posada and the other fellow that both of you have mentioned, Bosch. But as an example of the crows coming back to bite you in the eye, you point out that in 1973, Bosch plotted to assassinate Henry Kissinger for signing an anti-hijacking treaty with Cuba, and he staged two bombings while offering $3 million to the person who would assassinate Castro. Could you tell us about that?
Well, Kissinger was a traitor, according to Orlando Bosch. He had negotiated a treaty with the hated Fidel Castro. Remember, I said before that the hijackings began in December 1958, and they continued afterwards. Every so often, a Cuban would grab a plane in Cuba and fly it to Florida, where he was welcomed as a hero, and the planes were not even returned. In the late 1960s, hijacking started going the other way. Armed Americans would pull a gun on an airplane and fly the plane to Cuba, or have the pilot fly the plane to Cuba. Now, ironically, the Cubans arrested all of the people who arrived via this method, and they put him in jail. But jumbo jets were being grabbed in midair and flown to Cuba. The airlines, needless to say, were a bit preoccupied with this. And so Kissinger, bowing to the pressure and seeing that this was a no-win situation for the United States, to bring people back to those times, this was the times of the Black Panthers. This was the time of black militancy. And a lot of these people were facing serious criminal charges, and they figured the only way they could get away, the only way they could escape, was to hijack a plane to Cuba. So when Kissinger signed the treaty, this put an end to that. The Cubans then pledged they would not accept any more planes coming in to the Havana airport or any Cuban airport. Orlando Bosch said the idea of signing any agreement with the tyrant Castro was treason, and he set out about to assassinate Kissinger. In the meantime, of course, their target of targets was Fidel. Fidel estimates that all told, more than 600 separate assassination plots that he knew about were hatched by his enemies, many of them with CIA support. I'll just tell you about one, because I was told firsthand by one of the assassins. There was a man named, he's still alive, Antonio Veciana. Veciana's name in South Florida, of course, is very well known. He started an organization called Alpha 66. This was one of the early terrorist organizations. By the way, it's still going, although Veciana has retired. In 1971, the news was released that Fidel Castro would visit Chile. This was the time when Dr. Salvador Allende was president of Chile. Fidel stopped in there, was going to visit in the, early winter or late fall of that year. Veciana plotted then with Luis Posada Carriles. And I want to make a point. Veciana was a social democrat. He was a comrade of Eloy Gutierrez Menoyo, one of the comandantes in the revolution, who broke with Fidel on the grounds that Fidel was violating civil liberties. So Gutierrez Menoyo and Veciana were sort of, European socialist types. Posada was a way out fascist right winger. But as Veciana said, what did ideology have to do with killing? Nothing. He said, when you're out to assassinate somebody, you don't give a damn what their ideology is. You want somebody who kills. That's what assassins do. And of course, that's a very important lesson here. So the two of them worked together. And here was the method that they chose. Symbolically, they chose the media. They hired a television crew from Caracas. They had a camera, which the CIA had created. But instead of putting film in this camera, the CIA put a pistol in, so that when it was aimed at what the filmmaker was going to film, and the button was pressed, the trigger on the gun was released, and the bullet would fly through the lens of the camera and kill the intended target. In this case, it would be, of course, Fidel. And the crew was sent to Santiago, Chile, 2 months before Fidel's scheduled arrival. So they would blend in to the press corps there. Well, they got there. They had a real camera, which they had used all throughout the 2 months of pretending to be journalists. And then the day Fidel arrived, they brought the false camera with the gun in it. When Fidel started to speak, the cameraman aimed it at his head. And of course, he looked around first and saw Fidel's bodyguards at every door and chickened out. They tried it again in Caracas and failed again. That's an example of what Luis Posada was up to. And it was told to me by his collaborator. Without the CIA, of course, they couldn't have done it.
That's IPS fellow Saul Landau. I'm also joined by Jose Pertierra, and this is Defining the Issues from the Institute for Policy Studies. We're going to take a short break. Welcome back to Defining the Issues, the program of the Institute for Policy Studies. You can learn more about us at www.ips-dc.org. I want to welcome back the stations that have been airing this show on U.S. double standards on terrorism. And I want to go back to Attorney Jose Pertierra, who's representing the Venezuelan government in their extradition case for Posada. Jose, I want to ask your reaction to a quote from President Bush right after the 9/11 attacks. He said, "He who harbors a terrorist is as guilty as the terrorist." We started this show by pointing out that a U.S. federal judge had dismissed charges against Posada and that he is now free, presumably, Saul was suggesting, in Miami. Any reaction to the comment from President Bush?
I think he's right. I think he's absolutely right. Anybody who harbors a terrorist, protects a terrorist, foments terrorism, is indeed a terrorist. The only problem is that it is the United States government that has been doing this, not only with Posada Carriles, but with many of Posada Carriles' accomplices, some of whom have been mentioned by Saul a little while ago, who are now living free in Miami. Saul is also right when he says that the American policy against Cuba since the beginning of the revolution, and even as he pointed out before the revolution, has been founded on terrorism. It's the flip side of the economic blockade, a blockade that's designed to starve people into submission. It's using hunger or famine as a foreign policy tool. And alongside the blockade comes the terrorism that Cuba has suffered all of these decades. Posada, through his lawyers in federal district court recently, filed papers where he said that everything that he had done for the past several decades in Latin America had been at the behest of Washington. He claimed to have been an agent of the Central Intelligence Agency for over 25 years. That puts him well beyond 1976 when this plane was brought down. This is not something that Venezuela is saying or that Cuba is saying. This is what Posada himself is saying, that he was a member of the CIA in 1976 and during the time that he was committing some of the most horrendous acts in Latin America. He was sent to Caracas by the CIA. He was sent there in the late 60s to be our man in Caracas. Why? Well, the Southern Cone was exploding around this time. And in the early 1970s, we saw Allende's Chile rise up. And then shortly after that, the coup in Chile that led to Pinochet. As things heated up in the Southern Cone, things also heated up in Venezuela. There was an armed conflict going on in Venezuela. And there was a great deal of interest on the part of the CIA and right-wingers in Venezuela to put it down. And what better way to do it than to send a trained killer like Posada Carriles to capture, torture, and murder the people in Venezuela who were engaged not just in armed conflict, but in opposition politics in Venezuela. And I think the message of all this is that, yeah, Posada Carriles masterminded the downing of the plane, gads of evidence about that. This is the one of two volumes of evidence that we presented to the United States government about this 2 years ago. There's no doubt in anyone's mind that he masterminded the downing of the plane and many, many other attacks. But what's interesting is that you see during the course of perusing these documents that it's really the United States government that's been behind these acts from the very beginning. One of the men who was captured in Trinidad, who placed the bomb on the plane, Posada's right-hand man in Caracas, drew a diagram of the terrorist organization called Coru, who planned the attack of the plane. He drew it in his own handwriting. I don't know if you can see it from here, but it's very interesting. Coru, spelled up at the top. And it says, Consejo de Asesor. The executive committee, let's call it. And it has a little line, and it goes to the CIA, two men that are in charge of that. You go to the bottom, and he talks about jefes de área, chiefs of area, and underneath, FBI, and over here, CIA, in the handwriting of one of the people who placed the bombs. This is the detonator that was drawn also by the man who planted the bomb on the plane. And this individual is Posada Carriles' right-hand man. Posada Carriles masterminded it. But the ultimately responsible party is the United States government. Years ago, back in the 19th century, there was a Cuban philosopher by the name of José de la Luz y Caballero. A lot of people haven't heard of him here. Brilliant man. And he talked about slavery in Cuba. And he said of slavery then, what I think we can say of Washington and terrorism, that it's an ethical question, it's a collective sin, and it's a social cancer. And you can't fight a war against terrorism picking and choosing which terrorists you like and which you don't. All terrorists are criminals. All terrorists should be prosecuted. And those in Washington responsible for terrorism should be prosecuted as well.
Could you say just a little bit more, Jose Pertiero, what in this specific case of Posada Carriles would represent justice in your mind? What would be a just resolution?
The United States and Venezuela, John, signed an extradition treaty in 1922. In an extradition treaty, you list what are called extraditable offenses under the law. You can't extradite somebody for an offense that's not enumerated in the treaty. The number one offense in the treaty is homicide. Posada Carriles was indicted in Venezuela for 73 counts of first-degree murder. To show extradition, in other words, to establish that somebody is extraditable, you have to show probable cause. Probable cause is the most relaxed of legal standards. It's what justifies an arrest, not even a conviction, just an arrest. What a cop uses to arrest somebody. Here, there is a wealth of evidence that shows Posada was the mastermind of the downing of the plane and the murder of those 73 people. And Venezuela has demonstrated that to the United States by submitting these two volumes of documents. There's an arrest warrant against Posada in Venezuela. We submitted that. Venezuela was in the, or Posada was in the midst of a murder trial, his own murder trial, when he escaped from prison in 1985 with the help of his buddies in the United States. He showed up a couple of weeks later, by the way, working for Felix Rodriguez of the CIA in El Salvador as part and parcel of an operation that later became known as a scandal called Iran-Contra. It's always baffled me how somebody could get a job that sensitive so quickly after escaping from prison. I mean, usually it takes more than a couple of weeks to get a job, even at the 7-Eleven. But this guy got a job right away, you know, working in a very, very sensitive spot for the CIA. But anyway, in Venezuela, you cannot proceed to trial or proceed to a conviction or an acquittal if the defendant is absent. There's no in absentia hearings, in other words. And so Venezuela could not conclude the trial that was pending against Posada since he escaped. And what Venezuela did was order his arrest. And all of that has been submitted to the United States. The United States is obligated under that treaty to proceed to extradition. And if it does not extradite for political reasons, under two international conventions dealing with terrorism, one dealing specifically with a civil aviation, in other words, terrorist acts on civilian planes, called the Montreal Aviation Convention, signed in 1971. Under that convention, if the United States does not extradite, it is obligated, with no exceptions whatsoever, says the language of Article 8, to prosecute the individual in the country where the individual is found, that is, in the United States. So the United States is violating not only the treaty with Venezuela. The United States is violating some of the most sensitive international conventions dealing with the protection of innocent people in an age of terrorism.
Before I open this discussion up to our audience here at the Institute for Policy Studies, I want to turn back to Saul Landau one last time. You end your piece on this terrorist history that you've shared with us today with this comment. You say, maybe some aspiring candidates for the presidency will reflect on this recent terrorist history and reject covert means to achieve policy ends. Are you hopeful?
Well, I'm hopeful that grass will grow on my palm. I think that that's about as likely as any of the current candidates doing anything serious about the end of covert action. But every time covert action is undertaken, whether it's in Afghanistan or whether it's here in our own hemisphere, blowback results. That is, the consequences of grabbing a group of people and saying, go out there, murder other people, blow them up, poison them, do whatever you need to do to kill all these people, and not thinking about, well, what happens afterwards? What if they fail? What if they succeed? Either way, we're going to have a hell of a problem on our hands. We've certainly discovered this in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and today's session, we're talking about our own backyard. And part of that own backyard, by the way, is South Florida, Miami, where, you know, literally, people have gotten away with murder. And as long as you murder the right people, and you know the right people, you're going to get acquitted. I'll give you one last little sample of this. I should say, by the way, to my friend Jose Pertiera, that I'm not sure Bush knows what the word harbors means.
He probably thinks it's like a bay.
There was the case of a man named Sixto Reynaldo Akit Manrique, alias El Chino Akit. Anyway, El Chino Akit had been arrested by the anti-terrorist squad in Miami in the 1990s. They caught him literally pouring gasoline on a warehouse and putting blasting caps and fuses in and carrying an illegal weapon. Terrorism. They charged him with terrorism. All of a sudden, the charges were reduced, and he got off with a minimal sentence, which he served under house arrest. Anyway, it nevertheless was terrorism. And it says so in all the newspapers. In 2002, Mr. Bush was making a fundraising speech in Miami. And who's sitting on the platform? Three rows from the President of the United States. The same El Chino Akit. I said, how is this possible that the Secret Service would allow a man convicted of terrorism to sit three rows behind the president? So I called a former FBI agent, and I said, does the Secret Service not vet all the people close to the president? Oh, he says, their vetting system is absolutely foolproof. I said, well, wouldn't they then have known about this guy? He said, absolutely, they would have known. Well, how could he sit there? The answer was, orders from a very high source in the White House. So, all of a sudden, we have good terrorists and bad terrorists. Now, I'm sure if his name had been Abdul Akit, it would have been a different story.
Probably in Guantanamo.
Okay, I want to open this discussion up now to people in the audience. Please, we have a microphone here. We're speaking with Saul Landau. Saul, I should also mention, is the author of a new book called A Bush and Botox World, which is available here at IPS, and a new film called We Don't Play Golf Here, which is about environmental struggles of civil society in Mexico on the environment. Questions for either Jose or for Saul? Yes.
Well, if I can just make a very brief comment before I ask my question, and I just think that the U.S. is not beyond stooping to terrorism, even when it comes to more cases than Cuba. Cuba's probably a more intense example because it's even multifaceted beyond terrorism, a blockade and all kinds of other things, mercenaries in the country. But we can also look at Angola, Haiti, a number of places where terrorism has been deployed against these countries and the terrorists are being harbored in the United States. I can remind people also that Al-Qaeda is a brainchild or a product of the CIA. But my question is, I wanted to go to something that's directly related to this and also speaks about the double standard of the U.S. government regarding terrorism, and that is the case of the Cuban Five, which are actually five people fighting against terrorism and who are locked up in prisons. If our panelists can give any thoughts on that or any insight on that, I'd like to hear it. They actually, an 11th Circuit Court of Appeals overturned their conviction at one point and said that they should be given a new trial, but they're still in jail.
Well, Luis Posada Carriles is the raison d'etre for the Cuban Five. Had it not been for Posada Carriles and the crew of crows that Saul talked about, there would be no need for these Cuban Five to have come to the United States. As a matter of fact, in 1997, Posada Carriles masterminded a campaign of terror against the tourist industry of Cuba. Cuba was coming out of what they called the special period, an economic downturn that resulted from what happened to the Soviet Union and its allies. And they decided to come out of that economic downturn by turning to tourism. And so in order to terrorize tourists so that they would not go to Cuba, Posada Carriles masterminded this campaign to place bombs at some of the most luxurious hotels and famous restaurants and cabarets in Cuba, ranging all the way from El Hotel Nacional to La Bodeguita El Medio. These bombs are going off on a regular basis. He was doing this by taking money from New Jersey and Miami Cuban extremist organizations, using that money to employ Salvadoran and Guatemalans and sending them to Cuba with the bombs so that the bombs would explode. Cuba knew this. Cuba needed more information because they hoped, maybe naively in retrospect, but they hoped that the FBI would do its job, and that is prosecute terrorists, arrest terrorists so the Department of Justice could prosecute them. And Cuba sent men to the United States to penetrate not United States agencies, not to get classified information from the United States government, but to penetrate the Cuban exiled terrorist organizations that were carrying out these acts, that were funding Posada Carriles, who was at the time in Central America. They compiled the information, confirmed what Cuba thought was happening. Cuba turned that information over to the United States government. The United States government, instead of then arresting the individuals who were financing and planning this campaign of terror, the United States, through its FBI, decided that these organizations had been compromised, that somebody had penetrated them. And so they began an investigation on who could have penetrated them. And that is how they discovered the Cuban Five and arrested them and prosecuted them for, among other things, conspiracy to commit murder. Why? Because one of these individuals had penetrated Brothers to the Rescue. Brothers to the Rescue flew to Cuba on some planes, and Cuba shot down some of their planes. Therefore, this individual, who had nothing to do with the downing of these planes, was convicted of a conspiracy to commit murder. They also convicted some of them for conspiracy to commit espionage. This despite the fact that there wasn't a single classified document found in their possession or even alleged that they had. These individuals are rotting in prison right now, while Posada Carriles remains free to do his fourth grade quality paintings in Miami and sell them to people who would buy them. What you referred to, Nefta, there was a three-judge panel decision recently in Atlanta that overturned the conviction, saying that these individuals had been tried, have in a climate that had been contaminated with prejudice, a perfect storm of prejudice, said the 3-judge panel in its decision. Unfortunately, that decision was vacated by the court in its entirety, what we call the en banc court. And now the case is waiting a decision on several other issues, not dealing necessarily with the change of venue, which was what was at stake in the 3-judge panel decision. And I frankly am not too hopeful legally that they can win. The court in Atlanta is one of the most conservative courts in the United States. And I think the right thing to do would be to free these individuals and send them back to Cuba. And that they are heroes in this fight against terrorism. And the true culprits, the true terrorists, are sitting on the dais when President Bush speaks or painting in Miami.
Can I just add one line here? Just to give you an example of this and how well known it was, I'm going to quote you from the New York Times, 1998, that with a rueful chuckle, Posada described the Italian tourist death, the one that Jose referred to. He called it a freak accident, but he declared he had a clear conscience, saying, quote, "I sleep like a baby." It is sad that someone is dead, but we can't stop, he said. That Italian was sitting in the wrong place at the wrong time.
And I'll follow that with a quote from Posadas' buddy, Orlando Bosch. He says, recently to a television station in Miami, when asked about the bombings in Havana, he said, "Luis Posada did that. He paid a Salvadoran in a Central America." Apparently, Bosch didn't know that Salvador is in Central America. But he paid a Salvadoran and a Central American because they're half starving. You give them $100, they'll do anything. This one entered Cuba, carried the material in television. He planted 3 bombs, one in a hotel that killed an Italian, who, by the way, had a name. His name was Fabio Di Chelmo, and another in the Bodeguita del Medio. These guys brag about these things. You know, it's not a secret. Bosch, in another interview, speaking about the downing of the plane, "For me, it is a target of war. There are many things I cannot say, but they were actions of war. We agreed in Santo Domingo, when CODO was formed in 76, that everything that comes out of Cuba and gives glory to Fidel would run the same risk as those of us combating the dictatorship." So,
that's attorney Jose Pertiera. We'll take another question over here.
Could you two speak on the magical green card that Bosch got, speaking of Bosch, and the similarities between his case and the house arrest there and the Posada case?
Well, Bosch was in Venezuela, and where he was going again to go before court, and instead he magically got to the United States with the help of the U.S. ambassador at the time. This was 1989, a man named Otto Reich, called by his close associates Otto Third Reich. Otto Reich worked with President Bush to overturn the strong recommendation of the Department of Justice, the FBI, and the INS, saying that this man should not come to this country. He is a dangerous terrorist. President Bush the First ignored this, and Orlando Bosch returned to Miami, where he lives in his dotage, as I said before, planning terrorism with his, now he's lunching with his old buddy Luis Posada. So there's two of them plotting. So that's how he got his green card.
Jose, would you like to add?
Just a couple things. At the time, Ileana Ross Lehtinen, the congresswoman from South Florida, was running for the first time for Congress. Heading her campaign was a man who later became governor of the great state of Florida, Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush interceded with his father, who was in the White House, so that the father could pardon, if you will, Orlando Bosch to allow Bosch to live freely in Miami. The attorney for Orlando Bosch at the time is a man by the name of Raul Cantero, Batista's his grandson. That doesn't make him a bad guy, but yeah, Batista's his grandson, just curiosity note. And Mr. Cantero was nominated a couple years ago, I believe, by Governor Bush to sit on Florida's Supreme Court. This is a very incestuous kind of a relationship between the Bushes and Posada and Bosch. When the downing of the plane took place in 1976, the head of the CIA was George Bush's father. In 1985, when Iran-Contra was going on, the vice president of the United States was Bush's father. When Bush was pardoned, Bush's father was in the White House. Governor Bush, at the time, was running a campaign for Ileana Ross. And now we see Bush's son's role in protecting Posada during the last 2 years. It's very, very incestuous relationship.
I would add one other fact. Here at the Institute for Policy Studies, we, of course, suffered a terrible loss in September of 1976 when our colleagues Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt were car-bombed by agents of the Chilean secret police who had hired a group of anti-Castro Cubans to work with them. Two of them, Jose Dionisio Suarez and Virgilio Paz, had pleaded guilty to a conspiracy to assassinate these two people. When the FBI and the INS arrested them after they were released from prison, having served their terms, the INS picked them up and said, now we're going to hold them for deportation. President Bush the second, 43, disregarded the strongest opinions from the FBI and the INS and allowed these confessed conspirators to go free. So they, like Bosch and Posada, walked the streets of South Florida.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time. We've been speaking with attorney Jose Pertierra, who is representing the Venezuelan government in their extradition case for Posada, and IPS fellow Saul Landau, who has written extensively on Cuba, on the Posada case, and on the history of U.S. support for terrorism, the U.S. harboring of terrorism around the world. We've been discussing the U.S. government double standard on terrorism, which is so evident in this case. I want to invite those of you in our audience to join IPS and work on these issues. We have an evening school for activists called SALSA, which is also holding events on Cuba. Saul Landau has a trilogy of films on Cuba and Fidel Castro and has also just finished a trilogy of films on Mexico. This has been Defining the Issues. I'm John Cavanna. Please join us at www.ips-dc.org. Thank you very much.